Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. Also, the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 128. I'm recording it on Friday, April 24th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15, that's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this particular selection is Freddy's Menagerie. The title of the podcast is A Surprising Diagnosis. Our economy is suffering from Lyme disease. Yikes! We're suffering from Lyme disease. Let me see. I'm going to be talking about a book entitled Cure Unknown, Inside the Lyme Epidemic by Pamela Weintraub. I read this book, finished it last night, and I read it. My wife told me about it. My wife is, we know a lot of people who have Lyme disease. It's very disturbing to me. I probably know, if you counted all the people I know who have Lyme disease, I'll bet it's 20 people. And that's amazing. I'm not exactly a social butterfly, so that I would know 20 people that have Lyme disease is very frightening. Lyme disease is an epidemic where I live. I live in Purcellville, Virginia, Loudoun County. I believe that Loudoun County is one of the worst in terms of Lyme disease, but from reading this book, it's clear that it's a problem in lots of places. I'm amazed that there hasn't been more written about this. There's obviously been articles on Lyme disease in the papers and so forth, but I think it's a much bigger problem than it's being made out to be. I think it's a very serious problem, and there are many people who have Lyme disease who don't know it because of all the reasons described in this book. Lyme is frequently not diagnosed because the tests that they use, frankly, the tests that are permitted, don't always identify the symptoms that are Lyme as being Lyme. Many people don't even know they have Lyme. And Lyme can be, if it's treated early and treated effectively, it can be cured. I don't know if it's cured permanently, but in practical terms, it appears to be that it's cured permanently. Whether it's still lurking somewhere is not so clear, but the people get better. But if it's not treated, Lyme can be very, very serious. I mean, it can lead to, you know, blindness. It can lead to being in a wheelchair. It can, you know, I mean, it ultimately can lead to death. I mean, it's just, it can lead to dementia. It can leave you totally unable to function in life. Horrible headaches. Children get it, which makes it very sad. Children get it often because you get Lyme disease from being exposed to a deer tick. And of course, children often play in the woods or in parks and things like that. They roll on the ground all the time. So they get these ticks more often, frankly, than adults do. So there are a lot of young people with Lyme. So it's a very frightening disease and very serious. And I don't think focused on enough. But this, so my wife, she knows these same people that have Lyme, and she's somewhat concerned about it. My wife is interested in healthy eating, and there's some discussion in circles where people are talking about healthy eating, that building up your immune, eating healthy, eating less processed foods can build up your immune system, and building up your immune system can protect you from getting Lyme, possibly. I don't know that that's true, but that's a theory some people have. And so she had an interest in the subject, and when she saw it at the library, she got the book. And when she told me about it, I started seeing connections to our investing crisis. I was like, holy moly, you're telling me things that I'm living. I said, I've got to read that book. So I read it, and I finished it last night, and the purpose of this podcast is to point out the similarities in the Lyme epidemic and the way it's been mishandled, the way it's been mishandled by quote-unquote experts. And, of course, the parallel there is the way that the failure of the passive investing model of investing has been mishandled by the experts, causing great human misery in both cases. I'll start, just to give an overview, with a story that I read this morning by a man, a wonderful, wonderful man in the investing field, Professor Daniel Kahneman. I hope I've pronounced that properly. K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N, Kahneman. And I've read about his work before. I believe he's won some big Nobel Prizes. He's fairly famous, but he's essentially, I would say, I don't know a whole lot about him. I saw an interview with him that was wonderful once on the internet. And I saw this article today, and it was sort of an interview with him, but they didn't give the video. It was just a written up interview. But I would describe him as a behavioral finance. He explains, he goes into how people think, how people process information, and then applies that. Well, that's really his focus, is how people think, how people come to the decisions they have, and then applies it to financial questions, which when you look at how people think, what you learn is that none of our financial theories make sense. They're all, this is why, you know, the name of the book I'm working on is called Investing for Humans. We have these theories, which are nice. The people who came up with them are plenty smart, and they've generated many insights, but they're not real. They're not real world because they're not based on how humans behave. And the economy is a collection of humans. So unless you start looking at humans, you can't get it right. And the stock market is comprised of humans. So he told a story that I think serves as a good overview to the problem we're having in the investing field, but also this book indicates also in the medical field today. And I'm going to make a little effort to explain why we would be seeing similar phenomenon in two seemingly unrelated fields. But all I can do is put forward tentative thoughts. But the tentative thoughts are both, in a way, frightening, but in a way, a little bit encouraging. But I don't know. I guess it depends on whether you see the glass as half full or half empty. But Kahneman tells this story in the interview about some men. I think they might have been soldiers or something, and they were lost on a mountain, and they were lost, and they kept hiking, and they weren't making any progress, and they were getting increasingly desperate. They don't have food, and they're far away from civilization. And then, when things are getting really desperate, one of the guys happens to check in his pocket, and he finds a map of the mountain. And they say, oh, we've got a map. We're saved. And they look at the map, and they say, oh, here's what we have to do. We just have to go this way and, walk, another day, and we'll be out of here. We're going to live. And they do that. And they do find their way out. And then when they get back, to civilization, they're telling the story, and they get to the part where they say, oh, we thought it was over until, this one fellow here, he looked in his pocket and he had a map. And somebody listening to the story will say, let me take a look at that map. And he takes a look at the map and he says, well, he says, I'm glad this map, got you out of your trouble, but this is a map of a different mountain range. This isn't the map of the mountain you were in. Now, the point of the story is humans are placed on this planet with, all sorts of problems to overcome. We have to have food. We have to have relationships. All these things. And at some point, we have to invest the money we've saved. One of the things we have to do. And it's scary. Putting your money at risk is scary. And we need something to give us enough confidence just to get through the day. Just to be able to do the things we have to do. And one of the things that does that is we need some kind of mat. And the point of the story is these guys would have died if they hadn't found that mat. They were panicking. They were ready to give up. They would have died. They needed some confidence. And the map gave them confidence. Now, it was totally a false confidence. The map was of no help whatsoever. It was a different mountain range. It couldn't possibly have been a help. It was all wrong. But boy, did they cling to that map, because that was their hope. And that's what we are doing in the investing field. Passive investing has failed. The idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels is, in Rob Bennett's opinion, insane. It's an insane idea. The people who hold it aren't insane. The people who hold that idea are smart, good people. But the idea is insane. Why do they hold to it so tenaciously? For the same reason these guys held to this map that was a map of a different mountain range. People need something to place their confidence in. They need something to believe in, and we don't know how investing works. We're at a primitive level of understanding. But these people came up with the sufficient market theory, and they just jumped on it. They said, this is it. This is the answer. And as the evidence accumulates that it's not the answer, the reaction isn't to say, oh, yeah, well, let's get a different map. Maybe this is a map that might work. This valuation-informed stuff, that might work. Shiller's stuff, that might work. Let's go with that. They say, no, you're not going to take my map from me. I'm going to ban you. We hate you. You're not going to take away our map. That's what's going on. Now, people have a hard time accepting that. People think, well, whoa, all these experts, the experts are humans too. They're just like the rest of us. Yes, they went to school, and yes, they have experience handling money. That doesn't mean they're not frightened little rabbits inside. They're frightened little boys and girls. They're clinging to a map that is a map of the wrong mountain. And they've got to, you know, we have to change that. We have to somehow persuade these people to let go of the bad map and to pick up a better map. And of course, we can't tell them the better map is perfect because we don't know if it is. And what they're going to do every time we show them the map, the answer we get is, oh, that map might not be perfect. Well, they're right. It might not be perfect. But we know that the existing map is wrong. The evidence of that is overwhelming at this point. The same story applies with Lime. Now, I'll give one last example of this phenomenon of the people not wanting to give up the map. Jonathan Clements, the former columnist at the Wall Street Journal, by all accounts I've ever heard, a great guy, hardworking, hard ethic, you know, work ethic, kind, you know, generous, spirited, smart. But he wrote a column the other day that, oh, it sums up the whole problem. The title of the column was, I'm not apologizing. I mean, man, has he got a chip on his shoulder? Is he defensive? If he had written that column, I apologize, he could have changed the history of investing. I swear. Because other people would have started talking about the same thing. The way he should have written it was, I believed every word I said. But now that I've seen the human misery, I'm starting to have doubts. And I'm going to spend the next year exploring those doubts and learning. I apologize for my arrogance in thinking that I had found the one true path. Because looking at the devastation and the ruin of the efficient market theory, I'm not so sure anymore. I apologize. Maybe I was right. Maybe I'm not wrong. But I was too arrogant. I should have listened more. And if I had listened more and I was right, then I'd be more confident. And if I had listened more and I was wrong, I would have picked up a different map. I apologize. If he could say those words. But he can't. Today he can't. So I thought it was interesting to be able to get away from the investing stuff a little bit and just to show that the problem here is a human problem. It's not a problem of calculating the numbers. You know, if you want to know how that what the numbers say, go to John Walter Russell's site. John Walter Russell's calculated so many numbers for us. But the trouble is people need to be willing to look at John's numbers. It doesn't do any good for him to calculate the numbers if people are too scared to let go of the map they're holding on to and look at the new map. John is drawing the new map for us. He's in the process of doing it in real time before our eyes on the internet. Early-retirement-planning-insights.com. Check it out. Retire 5 years sooner than would otherwise be possible. Check it out. If you find any problems, please let me know and please let John know. But if you don't find any problems, well, you might want to let go of that old map. If you can't find any problems with the new map, maybe you want to let go of that old map. Since it's, I think it would be fair to say, it hasn't been working out so hot for 10 years. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to list the comparisons with the line problem and the investing problem, and then I'm going to go to the foreword of the book and maybe pull a few quotes out if I have time, because I didn't have time to go through the whole book and collect quotes. There's just too much. There's the comparisons here. I could draw hundreds of them. It's quite amazing. The big problem with Lime, I should give an overview of the problem with Lime. It's that, you know, read the book if you're interested, but well done book. She's a journalist. Of course, part of the story is that she was a science journalist herself. That was how she made her living, as was her husband, was also a journalist. I think also in the science field, but I'm not sure. And her entire family contacted Lime. They moved to a very wooded area. They thought they were doing a wonderful thing. It was a beautiful area of the country. And they all, you know, her boys contacted it, her children, and then her husband and herself, and she's been living with Lyme for years, trying to get it treated. And so while she's trying to get it treated herself, she's also a science journalist, so she knows the questions to ask to learn about the problems. And she knew she was onto the story of a lifetime, which is how I feel with the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. It's the story of a lifetime for someone who's a financial journalist. This is how I've made my living my whole life, and there's never been a story like this. We've had research showing that that valuations affect long-term returns dating back 28 years. And the experts today are still advocating passive investing, which is don't change your stock allocation in response to price changes. It's unreal. One of the quotes in the book, I don't have it on my list. The drama of all this story is that, well, maybe I should give that first. I'll give the background. But the background is Lime, I don't know when it was first discovered. I remember reading some articles, but it was a good bit of time now, a couple decades, I think. And what they did was it was discovered in a town called Lime. That's how it got the name Lime, L-Y-M-E. And they discovered that it came from this deer tick. And so I don't know how you have to write this stuff up in the science field, but basically I think they have to give guidelines to doctors. They define the disease. And the disease is defined as, you know, it comes from this tick, and, you know, it has such and such a symptom. You know, it generally causes joint pain and this kind of thing. And there's usually this, soon after the tick bites you, there is they call it a bullseye, mark on your skin where you were bitten. So if you see that bullseye and you rush in and get treated, they can do a test, I guess it's a blood test, that tells if you have the bacteria, I guess it is, or whatever it is, that comes from the tick. I guess it's a virus. I don't. The scientific stuff is not it's not for me. But anyway, you get something from this tick is the point. I can't go into the scientific stuff. That's, you know, you'll have to read the book for that. Although the scientific stuff does play a big part in the story. It is actually important, but it's just, I sort of skim over that. I'm interested in the human side of this story. They can do a blood test to tell if you have it, if you have Lyme. And if you have it, they can treat it with antibiotics, and it goes away, and everything is pretty much fine. But so they wrote it up this way when they first discovered it. They wrote up, you know, comes from a tick, you know, symptoms are XYZ, you know, the treatment is antibiotics for 2 weeks, whatever it is. But the problem is, ever since they did that, people all over the country have been getting Lyme in ways that don't fit the standard definition. They get it in geographic areas where it's supposedly impossible to get because that tick isn't there, but yet they get it. They get symptoms that are far worse than the symptoms described as Lyme symptoms. So the question is, do they have Lyme? They sure look like they have Lyme. The tests that are used are poor in that there are lots of false negatives and lots of false positives. So you could have Lyme, get one of these tests, and the test will say you don't have Lyme. But of course, in order to say whether you do or not, they have to have a demarcation. They have to say, well, if you have, you know, more than this amount in your blood, you have it. Well, if they get that demarcation wrong, there are going to be thousands of people who have Lyme who are told they do not have Lyme. In other words, they've got to get that right. And they made the decision to where to draw the line very early on, before they had much experience with the disease. And then, as people came in, they said, you don't have Lyme. So they're doing it all backwards. They jump to conclusions about what is Lyme and what isn't. And then, you know, for the rest of history, they're going to say anybody that doesn't meet that definition doesn't have it and therefore can't be treated for it. And therefore they get worse and worse and worse. So there's this drama playing out. And what's happened is, as more and more people get sick, patients are organizing. They're angry. They want to be treated. But they're a challenge now. They're a challenge to the quote-unquote experts who set up the definition and set up the rules for treatment. And they're saying, well, we can't get anything wrong. We're not apologizing. We're not going to admit we got this wrong. That would mean that we hurt people. We can't hurt people. We're good. We can't hurt people. We're smart. It's the same drama playing out in the investing field. The parallels are eerie, I think. So there was one place in the book with a woman, you know, the book goes on. It's, I don't know, 350 pages, I think. And at one point, the woman, you know, late in the game, after she's been through all these battles and told all these horrible stories of human suffering, the people that have this. I mean, her children, you know, you had to take them out of school. You had to take them off all their sports teams. They couldn't get out of bed. I mean, people that have Lyme disease frequently physically cannot get out of bed. They don't have the strength to get out of bed. They've got paralyzing headaches. They have to close their eyes if there's a light on. It's painful to see light. I mean, some of the symptoms are just horrifying. And they go to the doctors and they say, we can't do anything. Can't give you any antibiotics because you don't meet the test. And they go to other people who have the same disease and they say, well, you have to try this doctor. He might give you something, you know, and all this crazy stuff to get around the rules, which in theory are there to help people. But she had one interview that she did with somebody, you know, one of the so-called rebel doctors, the people who are you know, trying to help the patients instead of following the rules. And you know, he's saying, you know, very early on, he found, you know, what happens over and over again in the book as you read these stories is that all sorts of people are discovering all kinds of exciting things about how to treat Lyme. None of it perfect. Nobody knows. The title of the book is Cure Unknown. I'm not crazy about the title, but because it suggests that the drama here is finding the cure. And I really think the drama here is the battle between the experts and the rebel doctors who are trying to help the patients. That's how I see the battle. So I wish the title had focused on that. It's not a bad title, but it doesn't get to the biggest drama. But I think, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I think there would be a cure today if only these rebel doctors had been permitted to follow the research where it leads. In other words, there have been clues all throughout. We don't have a cure today, and I'm sure if we had a cure, they would give it. The idea that these doctors following the rules want the patients to suffer, you see, I think that's just preposterous. They don't want this. But the problem is they can't get from A to B without jumping over a chasm they're not willing to jump over. Today, cure unknown, B is where we all want to be, cure found, but in order to get from A to B, you've got to try some things out. You've got to take some chances. You've got to, you're obviously, some are going to be dead ends. Some of the research you're going to do is going to be a dead end. And it's going to cost money that, in theory, is quote-unquote wasted. But that's how people learn. And if you say, well, we have to know with 100% certainty that this research we do is going to solve every problem before we start, you'd never start anything. You never try anything. And that's, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little, but that's essentially the test that's being applied. If you want to get your research approved, you've got to prove in advance that you're going to answer every question. And that's what happens to me all the time. I go on discussion boards or on blogs, and I'll make a point, some small point, that the safe withdrawal rate's wrong. Everybody knows it's wrong. The numbers we give people to plan their retirements are wrong. We know this is a fact. It's not under dispute. First of all, the historical data is public information. Anybody who wants to calculate it can do so. It's not like Rob Bennett has some secret, files. Just do it. Go to Shiller's website and look yourself. But it's not even, you don't even have to do that, because you can go to big name people, not Rob Bennett, people with big names in the field who endorse passive investing. People like William Bernstein endorses passive investing, and he says the safe withdrawal rate's wrong. Scott Burns endorses passive investing, and he says the safe withdrawal rate's wrong. Larry Swedrow endorses passive investing. He says the safe withdrawal rate's wrong. He says the old school research is junk in, junk out research. Could you make a stronger statement? William Bernstein said anyone who uses the old school research to plan a retirement would be well advised to quote unquote forget about it. Yet, no one's corrected any of these studies for 7 years after the errors were discovered. Why? That's the chasm. If you acknowledge the studies are wrong, and say, I'm saying they say it's wrong, what they really say is valuations affect the result and valuations aren't included in the studies. But they never come out with the words, thus, the studies are wrong. They can't. Those are the words that can't be said. That's the taboo. And if you can't say what's wrong, you can't ever begin the effort to figure out what's right. That's the whole problem of our economic crisis, is that for 30 years we have known passive investing was wrong at some level of consciousness, and for 30 years we have resisted learning what's right because we don't want to say the words, this is wrong. We can't stand it. We can't stand to give up that old map. It frightens us. And the same thing is happening with Lyme, and I just thought it would be helpful to get a little perspective, to pull back from the investing side and look at how this happens in another field. I hope it's not a common phenomenon. I hope it's not happening all over the place. But it's clearly happening more than just in the investing field, judging by what I read in this book. So let me go quickly through the comparisons. The first comparison is doctors defined the problem too narrowly. Now, again, totally understandable, that what they did was they defined, they said it's only Lyme if, it comes from this particular tick, and if you have this amount in your blood and all these sorts of things. You have the, you have to have the bullseye thing, you know, rash, they call it, bullseye rash. Now, if you were starting today, you would not none of those requirements would apply. You'd say, well, no, Lyme can come from any of these various ticks. There's all kinds of ticks it can come from. We've seen it all over the country. Excuse me. Or we could say, oh, you know, you don't have to have this amount in your bloodstream. People with less than that have ended up suffering for years. So they had Lyme. But, you know, our old idea of what was required to qualify as Lyme, you know, if you were starting from scratch, I don't think there'd be anyone who would do it the way we did it. But at the time, what they did made sense. They didn't know. They didn't know. That's the first they'd ever seen this. So they said, yeah, it looks like you got to have this amount. It looks like, you know, it can treat it with antibiotics. Looks like it goes away, never comes back. That's not true. It was thought that that was true. In other words, they had patients come in. They gave them antibiotics for, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. And it went away. They were cured. I said, well, the treatment for Lyme is antibiotics for 3 weeks. Cure. Well, that's nice, except in the years since, there have been people who were treated for 3 weeks and it comes back. They hadn't treated enough patients in enough variety of circumstances. But once they wrote down, Lyme goes away with 3 weeks, that now they can't admit they were wrong. They can't change it. Is that a problem with science or is it a problem with humans? There's no problem with science. Science, you know, it's a tool. We use science to learn things. We're not applying the scientific process if we can't admit mistakes. And we're doing the same thing in investing. We're calling this passive investing stuff science, and it does have the trappings of science, and I think that's a good thing. I think making investing advice more scientific was a huge advance. That's the one good thing about the whole passive investing experience. Well, not the only good thing, but it's one big good thing. That it made investing advice more scientific. But the trouble is, we abandoned the scientific method when we became dogmatic about it. It's the dogmatism that's the problem. Dogmatism is not science. It's the opposite of science. So it's like this phrase, when they say, oh, to have Lyme, you have to check off all these, you have to have ABC. Well, they defined the problem too narrowly. They did the same thing in the investing field when they came up with this phrase, timing never works. They looked at research. There is indeed research showing that short-term timing doesn't work. And it's exciting. And they looked at that and they said, Eureka, we figured it out. Timing doesn't work. Tell everybody. Write books. Give speeches, you know, gin up some calculators, all good stuff. Except then there was research done showing, wait a minute, it's true short-term timing doesn't work, but long-term timing always works. And they said, oh, no. Didn't you know timing doesn't work? They don't want to redo the calculators. They don't want to redo the speeches. They don't want to redo the articles or the books. They defined the problem too narrowly. There's not only one form of timing. There's two forms. There's long-term and there's short-term. One form of timing, it may be true, never works. I tend to believe that's true. But the other form, every bit of evidence I've ever seen shows that it always works. But can anybody say that today? I mean, a few of us are saying it. But 90% of the experts aren't saying that today. That's why we're in this crisis. Doctors were smart. The doctors who came up with these rules, these definitions, these descriptions of the disease were smart people. Well, you know, I don't think there's any challenge to that. I've never saw in the book, I can't recall a single time, the woman told lots and lots of stories. I don't think there was a single case where she said any of the doctors lacked intelligence. Not a problem. Now, when you criticize, they get, you know, when you criticize, they get defensive on that score. You know, we're experts, you know, we go to, you know, whatever it is, Yale or whatever it is, you know, we're written up in the Journal of American Medicine, all this kind of thing. They're always relying on their credentials as their authority. The credentials are all earned and legitimate. There's no problem there. And it's the same thing in the investing field. The people who push passive investing always turn it to a discussion of their credentials. You know, we're smart, you're not, we know better. And they are smart. But the tragedy of these two stories is smart isn't the only thing that matters. You're smart, but you're also human, which means you're also fallible. And if you're not able to admit when you get things wrong, your intelligence becomes arrogance. And once it becomes arrogance, all your intelligence is going not to learning, it's going to avoiding learning. I believe that if you took all of the effort being put into investing knowledge today, 80% of it is directed to avoiding knowledge because the people doing the work don't want to accept that long-term timing works. They desperately don't want to accept that. And they put enormous resources into coming up with rationalizations for believing that the old model works. The media bought into the experts. This was a big part of the story. These patients would try to organize, and they would try to create public pressure to get the definitions loosened so that the people who have Lyme could go in and get their Lyme treated, and the people who need more than 3 weeks of the antibiotics could get it. In some cases, it takes years. Some cases, it might take 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or a year of the antibiotic treatment. In some cases, you have to keep coming back. You get the disease, you treat it, it goes away, it comes back. See, one of the things that it appears is happening, and I can't explain the scientific side because I'll just botch it up, but this virus or whatever it is, it hides. It appears. We don't know with certainty, but there's a lot of evidence that what's happening is the antibiotic kills it, but the virus has the ability to hide. It can sort of, you know, protect itself and hide. And so the antibiotic, when the antibiotic stops, it comes back out again. So the antibiotic doesn't always get it, especially if it's been a long-term case. So if it's something you got pretty quick, you might genuinely recover. But if it's been around a while, not so likely. And so the key is you've got to use enough antibiotics early on to genuinely kill the thing. But the treatment has always been the opposite. The treatment's always been to use as little antibiotics as possible. So what's happening is instead of doctors killing it, they're not doing enough to kill it. And it's staying alive, but they can't change. They're not allowed. What has happened in many cases is these doctors, they see how much pain the patients are in, and they say, I've got to treat it. I've got to give more than the standard treatment. And it works. The patients are recover, but then the doctors who determine the initial rules say, wait a minute, these people need to be driven out of their practice. They're making us look bad. We got to destroy them. And their practices are destroyed. Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Tragic stuff. But the media buys in, and the media buys in because it's a technical matter. You know, the average reporter doesn't know. I mean, this woman was a science reporter. She definitely knew more than most would. Most reporters, they don't know the technical. That's true in the investing area. They're intimidated by the expertise, and they say, well, if these experts say it, you know, my job is to report what they say. That's my job. And that's not really the job of a reporter in my book. Now, I guess people might have differing viewpoints, but a reporter is not a stenographer. A reporter should be digging. Now, certainly you should, you know, if some crazy person comes up with some theory, you should certainly go to the experts and get the other side. That's true. But if you notice a pattern where what the experts are saying doesn't seem to add up or doesn't seem to fit the reality, it's your job to report that, to report the contradictions. Yeah, we had this just the other day. There was a blog, Oblivious Investor, you know, where I had one of my guest blogs on the problems with passive investing. And I was calling for in that blog entry, I was saying we need a national debate on the problems with passive investing. And one of the things I mentioned is that Taylor Larimore, who's one of the big-time advocates of passive investing, author of The Bogleheads Guide to Investing, has abandoned it in the wake of the stock crash. He said, if stock prices, he hasn't done it yet, but he said if stock prices continue to drop, he's going to go to a zero stock allocation. That ain't passive investing. Passive investing is you stick to the same stock allocation. Now, he says he has to do that because he's retired and he won't have money to live on. So I fully understand his circumstances, and I don't say he's wrong, but it's not passive investing. Now, some, you know, he tries to make excuses. He says, oh, at my age, you know, I shouldn't be taking risk. That's all fine and good. But if at his age he shouldn't be taking risk, then he shouldn't have been taking risk before the stock crash. The stock crash didn't increase the risk of stocks. If anything, it diminished it. We're now, it diminished it greatly. The risk is much less today, now that we're at reasonable prices, than it was when we were at those insane prices. The problem is he miscalculated risk, as did all passive investors. Passive investors don't calculate risk properly because they don't adjust for valuations. If you don't adjust for valuations, you have no idea how much risk you're taking on. So the guy was taking on far more risk than he could afford. And whenever anybody came onto the board and tried to help him understand that, he'd call them trolls. He would smear them. He'd say, you're a troll for reporting what the historical data says. Get out of here. And now, he's thinking of selling all his stock. So I pointed out, you know, that one of the leaders, the lead advocates of passive investing, is abandoning the strategy. He hasn't done it yet, but he's intellectually done it. He's acknowledged that he'll need to do it if prices drop. And Taylor, I presume, went to the blog owner and told him, oh no, you're misquoting me. This is what they always say, you're misquoting me. All I'm doing is reporting a fact. And the guy deleted what I had said. So I, said, because the person being referred to had notified him, I misquoted him. So I just put up a comment and I said, look, I'm not misquoting him. I said, here's a link to the thread where he tells us this. You know, read it for yourself. And over at Goon Central, they're all worked up. They're saying, oh, Rob is so mean. You know, Taylor was a veteran, all this sort of thing. I'm like, of course he's a veteran. I'm not saying he's not a veteran. What I'm saying is Taylor could help us all to learn. He could help himself learn, and he could help the rest of us to learn by simply acknowledging that his belief in passive investing caused him to miscalculate risk. And he's been brought to this pass where he has to sell his stocks, which is unfortunate. I'm not trying to hang the guy on a cross for it. I'm just saying let's learn from it. It's a great learning experience. But it doesn't help to play word games and pretend that selling all of your stocks at a market bottom is passive investing. That's not how passive investing has ever been described before. It's not how Taylor ever described it before. He never said before that he was going to sell all his stocks if prices, and you know, the crash was totally, expected. If you were familiar with the historical data, which I don't think Taylor is, but by choice he's not. Anyway, I don't want to go off on that riff, but the point here is the media, you know, if some other reporter, you know, I've studied this for 7 years, so I sort of know the answers to these challenges. But if some reporter didn't know the background and they were challenged in that way, they would tend to become intimidated. They'd say, oh, I guess I'm wrong. Because the experts are telling me I'm wrong. So we need journalists that will take on, in a kind way, not in a nasty way, but will take on the experts. We all need that. The experts need that. The experts need to be taken on in order to see themselves, how flawed their thinking has become. And we don't seem to have that to the extent we need it. The journalism is essentially a check and balance in our society. It holds the experts, you know, their feet to the fire. Again, I hope not out of nastiness. Sometimes I think it is done out of nastiness, but it shouldn't be. It should be done out of a desire to encourage a learning experience for everyone. And in these fields, maybe it's because our society is becoming more technical. Information is becoming more specialized. That journalists no longer feel that, you know, maybe if you're dealing with a political thing, they feel they can take the experts on because everybody feels they understand politics. But when you get to these technical matters, the journalists, a large number of them, don't feel competent to take on the experts. And that causes the experts to continue down this bad path. And the farther they go down, the harder it is to turn around. Because now they've caused more human misery each year that goes on, both in the Lyme matter and, you know, in the investing area. New science is rejected. This is so painful. Throughout this book, you see these doctors doing tests, doing studies, trying to show that the initial definitions are wrong, that Lyme is a broader problem than was initially understood. And, you know, the funding is rejected, the research is rejected, because it makes the original map look bad. So everything's turned around. The way you're supposed to do it is you look at the realities and then you draw your treatment guidelines from the realities. The way it's worked is we decided on the treatment guidelines, and then we said, well, reality has to fit. And anytime reality doesn't fit, we just throw it out. And that's what we do in the investing area. There's a mountain of evidence that long-term timing works. A mountain of it. But it all is in conflict with that statement, timing never works. And so we don't consider it. All sorts of publications and websites will not write about the evidence because it doesn't fit that preconceived notion that timing never works. That's the treatment guideline that we cannot change. We're not permitted to change. This is why you see board bannings. Because if you tell people, that if you point people to the evidence, people are going to get wise. And people who are tied in, people who are, I'm tempted to say profiting, but I don't want to suggest it's a financial motive. But people who are organizationally profiting, they're tied in to the old understanding, don't want to acknowledge the weaknesses, and they don't want others to learn. It's anti-learning. The problem keeps coming back. My fifth comparison. What they do is they'll make some little change in the treatment guidelines with the hope of killing this thing, but it always comes back worse than ever before, because more and more patients are getting Lyme and they can't be treated. And we see this in the investing area. They come up with these sad little things where they'll acknowledge a tiny little point. They'll say, I remember they used to say, the safe withdrawal studies, they're just a rule of thumb. You know, in the beginning, they were science. Then it became, they're just a rule of thumb. Now the rule is, it's embarrassing to talk about. Let's talk about something else. You know, safe withdrawal rate research is no good. Let's not do it. Safe withdrawal rate is incredibly good. There's nothing wrong with the idea. It's just a question of you have to calculate the numbers accurately. There's a difference between calculating them accurately, looking at all the factors that apply, and ignoring the valuation factor. You get different answers depending on which you do. It's not the idea of calculating the safe withdrawal rate that's bad. It's the idea of being unwilling to calculate it accurately that is bad. Now, here's a killer. Comparison 6. The doctors ended up saying the patients are crazy. As more and more patients showed up saying, I'm not supposed to have this problem according to the treatment guidelines, but I sure do. I can't work. I can't get out of bed. I'm dying. I'd like some treatment. The doctors had to answer that. Well, the answer they came up with is the patients are crazy. They said they're all manufacturing it. These thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, I don't know, said, I think I know 20, just in my little circle. They're all making it up. They all want attention. They're all pretending. They're all faking. In some cases, entire families have it. So what do they say? Why are the children faking? They say, they had some syndrome, Manchusian syndrome or something. It's some syndrome where supposedly The children notice that the parents are faking, and the children decide to fake to make the parents feel better about their faking. I mean, this is so preposterous. But you hear the same thing in the investing area. You know, I'll point out all the time, why would Larry Swedrow say that the old school studies are junk research when Larry Swedrow himself advocates passive investing? Why would he do such a thing? They have no answer. And they'll just say, what they'll come up with is, you're crazy, Rob. You're insane. This is what I get. You're insane. Because it's the only thing left. When all of the evidence points one way, the only thing left is to say the person presenting the evidence is crazy. I mean, this is sad. It's not an effective response to the evidence to say the person presenting the evidence is crazy. A doctor's role is to help the patients, not to label them insane. If it were one patient, sure, you could say, look, you know, we've got thousands of, you know, hundreds of years of research showing such and such. You know, it's hard to believe that this one case, it's all different. Maybe the person, you know, does have some issues. Not when it's thousands and thousands. Then that just doesn't fit. Seventh comparison, it looks like a conspiracy, but it probably isn't. There are conspiracy theories about Lyme. People say, oh, the government, you know, doing it to us or whatever. They tested some kind of thing and it didn't work and it's spreading. And the author of the book basically dismisses that. She just says, I haven't seen proof of it. You see this in the it's hard for people in the investing field not to conclude that there's some kind of conspiracy. You know, why have I lost all my retirement? That's sort of what they're doing when they blame the bankers. You know, why have I lost all my retirement money? Oh, the bankers did it. These bad bankers. It's like conspiracy theories. But when you research it, the conspiracy theories don't really stand up. What exactly did these bankers do? Did they put the money in suitcases and get on a flight to Rio? What did they do exactly? All that the bankers did, and you know, it's a serious thing, but it's no more serious than what all the rest of us did. They miscalculated risk. That's what we all did. The bankers just did it on a bigger scale. You know, they had more money at their disposal, and they miscalculated risk on a bigger scale. But we all miscalculated risk. Anybody who went with a high stock allocation from 1995 through 2008 miscalculated risk. So why are the bankers any more guilty than the rest of us? It's not a conspiracy. Not in the conventional sense of that word. It's millions of people behaving improperly. That it is, but not because they all got together and with some kind of bad motive made a plan and stuck to it. It's because we desperately want a map. And we pretended we had the final map when we didn't. And now we're scared to death to admit that we got it wrong. Comparison 8, money is an influence. Now here you get into the question of motive, and it gets dicey. But she has a chapter where she goes through, you know, sort of why did this happen, and she basically says it's a big problem is a lot of the doctors who came up with these treatment guidelines, they have consulting arrangements with insurance companies. They get financial rewards for limiting the number of people who can be treated. Now, I think you have to be careful. I don't think that means that these people wake up in the morning saying, you know, I want people to suffer from Lyme. I do not believe that. And I don't believe that the passive investing advocates wake up in the morning saying, I want people to suffer busted retirements. I don't believe that. But I do think money is an influence. There's millions of dollars to be made telling people that timing doesn't work. And there's millions of dollars to be made denying people treatment for Lyme. And that influences human thinking. When we know there are millions of dollars to be made by taking one route, we're inclined to take that route. And once we take that route, we're inclined to rationalize because we want to be good people. We want to think of ourselves as good people. So a problem here is the money. It is a problem. It does have to be looked at. But we have to be careful. I have a podcast, the good populism, the bad populism. If you start saying all the people involved are bad, you create a mess. First of all, I don't think it's true. And secondly, it just makes people more, they're going to dig in their feet that much more, dig in their heels that much more. You have to tell the truth. It does appear that money considerations play a role. We have to do something about that. We have to provide financial incentives for telling the truth about Lime and about stock investing. We have to provide financial incentives for telling the truth so people hear the other side of the story. And once people hear the other side of the story, well, people can decide for themselves what they think. The financial incentives have to be redone. But we have to be careful. It's a delicate thing because you're challenging people's integrity if you don't phrase it carefully, in my view. Nine, the great anger evidences itself in both debates. When the patients try to organize and get treatment and doctors help them, the ones who favor the old treatment guidelines become viciously angry, and they go after these people and prosecute them. And it's just amazing that doctors could be prosecuted for trying to help their patients. But the same thing's true in the Investo world. You see this anger. Whenever you see anger, in my view, it should tell you something. It doesn't tell you what the safe withdrawal rate is. It doesn't tell you the details. But it tells you there's a problem. When you see that, you see as much anger as we have seen. When passive investing is challenged, you know there's a problem. You should. And then you got to dig. You got to find out, well, you know, digging takes some time. That's what I do, the digging part. But everyone should be on notice when they see that anger. There's something wrong here. There's something wrong here. She ultimately identifies what I think is the real problem, managed care. Now, again, this gets real tricky politically because the reason managed care is the problem, I think, is, I mean, managed care may have been necessary. I'm not saying it was a bad thing any more than I'm saying making investing advice scientific was a bad idea. You see, our society reached a point where there had to be these things. I think we're growing as a society and these things, it just reached a point. But managed care does cause a problem. And the big problem is managed care means there's some gatekeeper who's making a decision as to who can get treatment. And it's not the doctor who sees the patient. When the doctor makes the decision, the doctor can see the pain that the patient is in. And that's going to influence his decisions. And that's why a lot of these doctors became rebels. They just had patients who were in such pain and they couldn't say no. They'd look in their eyes and say, I can't deny you. You know, the treatment. I can't. In good conscience. But the gatekeeper never has to look at the patient. You know, the gatekeeper, it's just numbers. And the gatekeeper gets bonuses based on, you know, how much better he makes the numbers look. And of course, when you deny treatment, the numbers look better. So what we did with managed care is we separated the person who sees the patient from the person who makes the treatment guideline. And from that point forward, you can't put the same confidence in those treatment guidelines as you could when doctors saw the patients. It changes it. Changes the realities. The same thing's true with investing. You know, the rules for investing, a lot of the experts are people who sell stocks for a living. How could they not be influenced by that? And they work for mutual funds that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting passive investing, telling us stocks for the long run and timing doesn't work and all this sort of thing. You know, Jonathan Clements can't apologize today. Well, he mentioned in the article, he wrote over 1,000 columns promoting this stuff. You know, he did it for good reasons. But I think it's fair to say it's sort of hard for him to acknowledge the problems. We need someone other than him to make the case. But who's it going to be? Shiller did it. But who else? Shiller acknowledged. I saw an article a couple days ago. Shiller acknowledged that he felt intimidated about telling the truth. He said he would always cut back on what he knew. Because if he told the full truth of what he knew from his research, he would be attacked as unprofessional. Well, if Shiller, who has tenure and has researched this for decades, is afraid to tell the truth. What do you think Jonathan Clements is? Not necessarily even being aware that he's afraid. His brain won't allow it to process because he knows that this is big. And it affects lots of people. And it affects lots of reputations. And it affects his own reputation. The managed care thing may be necessary, but we have to deal with the problems that it brings up. And the idea of making investing advice scientific may be necessary, but we're going to need to deal with the problems that come up. I have comparison 11. No one really believes that all the people, you know, who did this are bad people. I've already said that. It's a bad system. It's a systemic problem. It's not a bad people problem. It's a bad system problem. But the people in it are going to need to acknowledge that in order for us to change it. I have comparison 12. It's not a political issue. I don't see in the book that it's a big drama being played out in this book between the doctors that wrote the original guidelines and support the original guidelines and the doctors, the rebel doctors who are trying to treat the patients in pain. It's not a liberal conservative divide. There are obviously liberals that have Lyme disease. There are conservatives that have Lyme disease. There are liberals who want to treat those patients and there are conservatives who want to treat those patients. There are liberals who want to stick to the original guidelines and there are conservatives who want to stick to the original guidelines. That's both a problem and an opportunity. It's an opportunity because since it's not a political question, if we could all just sort of work together to solve it, we could all work together to solve it. There doesn't have to be any nastiness or any division. Same thing in the investing area. There's not one person who benefits from not investigating the flaws of passive investing. Not one person in the world. It's not a liberal versus conservative matter. But I think the downside is when it's not a liberal conservative matter, it's hard to get on the agenda. If you have a liberal issue, you've got lots of friends who are going to help you. And if you've got a conservative issue, you've got lots of friends who are going to help you. But Lyme is neither one. It's just a pain issue. And our economic crisis is neither one. It's just a pain issue. You know, it's a problem and an opportunity both. Well, the last comparison I wrote here, and I may have to stop with the comparisons, is no cure. That, you know, the name of the book is Cure Unknown. The reason, in my opinion, why there's no cure is that the efforts to reach a cure are so limited. You know, there's so much resistance to the research that we can't find the cure. If only we would allow the research to go forward, we would find it. Same thing's true in investing. I don't claim to know everything about how investing works. Far from it. What I say is we should at least be on the path of trying to learn. We know that passive investing has failed. I know it anyway. If no one else does, I sure do. So I'm going down a different path. All my work is aimed at, you know, what does work. But if thousands of people, if Jonathan Clements and John Bogle and Bill Bernstein and, you know, on and on and on, we're all working to find what works, I think we would be far, you know, we'd be way, way along the road to finding what works. But you've got to try. If you can't even acknowledge that we've got the retirement numbers wrong with all the proof, how are we ever going to learn what's right if we can't admit what's wrong? And I see a parallel there to the Lyme matter. I'm going to try to, if I can, fit in a couple quotes here from the foreword to the book. The foreword was written by a woman, Hillary Johnson, who wrote a book on fibromyalgia, Osler's Web. And she just, you know, she sort of gives a survey of the book, and I'd like to read some of her quotes, but I'm not going to have time for many. But one she says here, in my experience, the last thing patients are seeking is sympathy. What they want instead, quite desperately, is biomedical research. That's what they want. They want some people to try to help them. That's what middle-class investors want. They don't want battles. They want answers. We can't get the answers, though, until the old school is willing to acknowledge that there's some problems. They're often, I'm quoting the woman, they're often referred to as stakeholders by government agencies as if simply calling them what they are, sick people, threatens the established order. Isn't that the truth? mentioning that the old school studies get the number wrong. The only thing bad about it, I'm treated as if I'm doing something bad when I point this out. I'm being mean. What's bad about it is it threatens the established order. In describing what she calls the Sartre-esque world of the Lyme afflicted, Weintraub notes that only the richest and best connected of patients, a made person, can receive truly comprehensive treatments. And there's some truth in that in the investing area. I've read things where quote-unquote experts who will not acknowledge the problems will hint, at least, that you need to change your stock allocation to the clients who want to hear that. Bogle does that. He puts out warnings from time to time. He puts out the warnings because I think his conscience, you know, mandates it. His conscience says, I've got to tell people. They're going to get crushed. But he can't make a general announcement because that would cause a nuclear explosion. So he sorts of hints at it. And the people who are a little skeptical of the conventional line, they pick up on it and they lower their allocations and they're saved. But why not make this general information? That's what I want to do. About journalists. In their desire to be scientifically accurate or adhere to the much vaunted journalistic ethic of objectivity, they become stenographers, mistakenly assuming the summary answer to any scientific dilemma can be resolved with a conversation with some government employee in the cinder block offices of the Center for Disease Control. You know, it's just the problem there of the journalistic. You know, journalists are important. I mean, I'm a journalist, so I think they're important. We've got a serious job, and we need to take it more seriously. We can't just go with what the experts say. That's, you know, we should be friendly with the experts. We should be kind, but we should be respectful. But, you know, we can't just buy into it 100%. The ancient and formerly revered scientific rule known as Occam's razor, which holds the simplest explanation is probably the correct explanation, has no credence in the brave new world of contested diseases. Common logic, anecdotal evidence, and on-the-ground clinical observations, by which I mean the simple process of doctors listening to and thinking about what their patients are telling them, are held in disregard by the most powerful players in the research establishment. That's what I think goes on in investing. Simple common sense tells you the timing must work. Long-term timing. How could timing not work? Timing is just lowering your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. How could that not work? It's common sense that it works. But we're not allowed to say that. It's banned. So many places. It's banned because it's a challenge to the conventional wisdom that timing never works. The reality is some forms of timing never work. Other forms always work. And it shouldn't be taboo to say that. These are hardly cordial disagreements. Bodies are strewn everywhere. And for the moment, I am not referring to the afflicted, but to the healthy. You know, the fact that this is the anger question. The fact that there's so much anger when you talk about what the historical data says about safe withdrawal rates and about investing in general tells you that there's something wrong here. Why would there be bans on honest posting at Motley Fool and at Morningstar and at Index Universe and at Bogleheads? Why? There's a story there. That's the whole story. Once we understand why there's so much anger, we understand that humans have a desperate need for a map. And we locked ourselves into a map that's a map of the wrong mountain. And we need to work up the courage to let go of that map and to pick up a better map. And what we need to have thousands of people working together to write that better map, not just Rob Bennett. But my goal is just to get people to drop that map. And that means dropping the anger, dropping the attitude. When we drop the attitude, it all opens up for us. Wonderful things can be done. So many people, so many smart people who can make contributions. But you can't do it as long as you're angry. As long as you're angry, you're defensive. You're not learning. Defensiveness, you know, is the opposite. Is the opposite of, you know, of learning. Experts have imposed a rigid template on an entity they don't fully understand. Because their studies flow from the disease definition rather than the other way around, they have generated information about a disease model, but not the disease itself. That's what's happened in investing. The efficient market theory is a disease model. We're spending all our time talking about the efficient market theory instead of talking about how to invest effectively. The efficient market theory looks at one third of what investing's about, the stuff that can be reduced to numbers. It ignores investor emotion, which is 70% of the problem. We're spending all of our energies on the disease model, not on the disease. It should go the other way. We should be worried about how to invest effectively. And if that's our concern, we won't be using the efficient market theory. We'll be using something else. It may have elements of the efficient market theory in it, the stuff that the efficient market theory gets right. We're obviously not going to throw that overboard. But this idea that you don't need to pay attention to valuations when prices get to insanely dangerous levels, that truly has to be thrown overboard. Unless somebody can come up with some sort of logical defense of the idea. And if there were a logical defense, we wouldn't be seeing the anger. You know, the anger comes from the fact that there's no logic, that it's all emotion at root. It sometimes seems as if the remarkable technological and scientific advances of the last half century have served to create a medical dead zone in which these contested diseases must languish because the science is still being worked out. See, that's the problem. That's the map problem. We don't know all the answers. The challenge that's always put to me is, Rob, we'll let you discuss this stuff if you can show with 100% certainty that you know every last answer. You have to prove that you know absolutely everything. And then fine. Then we'll go forward with the discussions you say you want to have. And I obviously can't do that. What I'm saying is we need to start the discussions, not end them. But we can't start them until we can acknowledge that maybe the experts got it wrong. Is that possible? Can we say that? Now that we've lost, you know, one third of our retirement money, can we say that? I think we need to say that. That's if we can't say I got it wrong, we at least need to be able to say I'm not sure. If we can say I'm not sure, we can move to the next stage. And if we can move to the next stage, nothing is impossible. These power players include pious academicians who have little or no contact with patients who suffer from these maladies, yet form opinions and theories about them that carry far more weight in the medical community than is scientifically warranted. They reduce science to theology, changing the essential question from what do the data say to do you believe in this disease or do you not? That's what's happening with the efficient market theory and with passive investing. It's theology. The worst kind of theology. Dogmatic, vicious, angry theology. The worst kind. How many times in our discussions we've seen comparisons to religion in these discussions and in the board bannings and all this sort of thing, the smear campaigns. And the reason why is that comes out of fear. Dogmatism is fear. Dogmatism is fear. And our country is rooted in a non-fearful impulse. You know, when we have something like free speech, that's an expression of confidence. They call it the American experiment. That's an expression of confidence that we would allow different viewpoints to be expressed because we believe that if people hear different viewpoints, they can work it out. But we don't have different viewpoints being expressed on passive investing. No. We have board bannings. We have prohibitions on honest posting, on safe withdrawal rates, and other valuation-related questions. We have anger. We have smear campaigns. Personal attacks. Intimidation. Word games. Deception. Why? Well, on a question about how to invest our retirement money? On a numerical calculation, we see this stuff? Why? Because we're afraid. We're afraid to give up that old map. We can spend $1 trillion on stimulus and not change this problem, in my opinion. We could spend nothing and work up the courage to discuss the real issues, the real fears, and we can do a great deal. That's Rob Bennett's opinion. Okay? don't take what I'm saying, you know, any more dogmatically than I'm telling you to take everything else. But I hope you'll consider the possibility. Because I think it's a real possibility. The last one is at the very end of the foreword. Oh, she says, I sometimes wonder if the only investigative writers who will possess the necessary temerity to remove the white gloves and tackle these putative experts to the ground will be those like Weintraub and the late Randy Schultz, he wrote a book about AIDS and the band played on, whose personal experience demands that they follow the rocky trail that leads to the truth. Truth is a rocky trail. Truth is at the end of a rocky trail. I agree wholeheartedly with that woman's statement. What's her name? She's the author of Osler's Web, Hillary Johnson. Her book was a different book. The book I'm talking about is Pamela Weintraub, Cure Unknown, Inside the Lyme Epidemic. But Hillary Johnson wrote a book on fibromyalgia. But she says truth is at the end of a rocky road. You see, that's how you uncover truth. I have told people, I said, come to the website, look at the calculators, you know, look at the articles, look at the podcast, listen to the podcast. Tell me what I get wrong, please. One of the reasons I go to Goon Central, where people, you know, hate me, I think it'd be fair to say, is because those people will challenge me. And if I get something wrong, I want to know it. That truth is at the end of a rocky road. It doesn't have to be a nasty road. What it could be, it doesn't have to be rocky in the sense of attacks. It's going to be rocky in that we're not going to know it all starting out. In other words, if Jonathan Clements were to come out and say, I apologize because I acted like I knew more than I did, which is what I'm urging him to do, and all the others, not just Jonathan, obviously. That would be a little scary. It might even cause stock prices to drop in the short term because people will lose confidence in the early going because they'll be scared. In the long run, though, it's going to pay off big because in the long run, if we give up that old map, it's going to click. We've already seen hundreds of people who get it. You see them reporting at John's site and at my site and on the boards. When you let in the realities of what the data really says about, you know, some forms of timing don't work, some do, some are required, you gain confidence because for the first time you're following an investing model that makes sense, you know, satisfies the dictates of common sense, and two, is vindicated by real world results. You don't lose confidence in your investing strategies over time. You gain confidence in your investing strategies over time. That's the kind of model we need, a model that gets better over time instead of worse. We got to jump that chasm. We got to drop the old map and pick up the new. And we're seeing evidence of it in other fields. We're seeing it in the medical field. And I think it's because our society is evolving. It's going to a new level of growth. And we have to tackle new questions. That's what crisis is all about. People think of crisis, you know, we're in an economic crisis as a bad thing. And of course it is. It's a scary as the Dickens. But there's opportunity in crisis. Crisis, there's a purpose in crisis. And a crisis occurs because the old rules have broken down. The old system has broken down. When we find that new system, we're going to find incredible explosions of opportunity and growth. So there's a good side to this. And that's how we stay away from doom and gloom, is to focus on the good. And I think there is good. Both in the search for a cure for Lyme, I think if they opened up the rules a bit, they could find a cure, which would be wonderful for all these people in pain, and in Investo World, where we need to at least acknowledge that maybe we got it wrong with all this passive investing stuff. Maybe we got it wrong. Maybe there's a better map than the one we adopted 30 years ago. Maybe we need to acknowledge that we're a little fearful. And the only way to overcome our fears is to acknowledge them and deal with them. Good luck with your investing strategies.